E-12 Education Finance Committee will come to order, and I just want to welcome everybody here. I know we have quite a people, and it's nice to see you here. We will have more members coming as we get started. I'd like to make one adjustment in the schedule, and Senator Latz has a commitment, a speaking commitment, and we'll take Senate File 203 first. And before we get started, I would just like to mention to the committee members that we have the bills before you on your agenda that we'll work on today or this morning. And then we also have a meeting tonight at, was it 6?
6 o'clock.
6 o'clock. We'll pick up where we have left off. So most of the proposals that we will be dealing with are grant-type proposals. And so as our budget gets put together in the next few weeks, we will be looking at the resources going into these particular programs. Senator Scogin?
Mr. Chair, just so you know, I have to present across the hall about 9 o'clock, so I'm going to step away from the table for a few minutes.
Okay, thank you. Yes, there's a rash of committee meetings that are all going on at the same time. So, but we'll get started. And again, thank you all for coming and being part of this and watching government in action. Senator Latz?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate the opportunity to come before you today and support a Senate File 203. This is a bill that would that proposes to raise the general community education levy back to the 2002 level. Those of you who were around in 03 may recall that there were a number of cuts that were made in connection with resolving the budget crisis at the time. One of those cuts was to the community education levy. And there was a little bit of it was brought back last biennium. This bill would restore it to its previous level. The other portion of the bill would raise the census threshold also from its current level of 1,335 people to 2,000 people, which is the population of the district, the school district that's used to enable the districts to set their levies. And that change would primarily benefit greater Minnesota communities that need to have at least some threshold that they can use to raise the money to support any community education program. There is a fiscal impact, which you'll note on this. It's in 08, it's $582,000. 09, it's $596,000. That's the aid portion of the community education funding system that is tied to the formula when the local levy gets increased at the discretion of the local school district. It carries with it an aid component that comes out of state revenues. The League of Minnesota Cities has a letter, which you should have in your packets, I hope, in which they support this increase. In St. Louis Park, I know very firsthand where I'm from, the city and the school district work in a very close partnership in supporting community education. But as you can see from the letter, that kind of a partnership is apparent all over the state, where the cities often help pay for local community education programs. As the community education levy has gone down, the cities have been forced to step up to the plate to help replace some of those finances in the community ed programs. However, in most school districts, the boundaries of the cities are not the same as the boundaries of the school district, and then the burden of the local community education program falls disproportionately on the city residents who are paying their taxes, And less so on the other members of the school district who are not part of that city that is helping to pay for it. I'm proud to say I served on the Community Education Advisory Council in St. Louis Park, which oversaw a whole variety of programs. It was a joint partnership of the city and the school district, and we covered early childhood programs, family education programs, the senior programs, a whole variety of community education programs, and other programs just for the general community that would provide opportunities for lifelong learning for the residents of St. Louis Park. It happens our school district and city have almost contiguous boundaries, so it worked well for that partnership. My family has also participated directly in the early childhood family education programs. I think I'm a better parent for it. I think my kids are better off for it. And I'd like to see that opportunity be extended to as many people in Minnesota as possible. I have with me Mary O'Brien, who is the Director of Community Education in St. Louis Park. And I'd like to ask her to make a few remarks as well, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Senator Latz, for the nice explanation of your proposal. Ms. O'Brien.
Mr. Chair, Senators, thank you for the opportunity to speak with you today. My name is Mary O'Brien, and Senator Latz gave me a promotion. Actually, I'm not the Director of Community Education.
I've known you for so long.
I know. It's so nice, though. I'll tell my boss when I get back. Oh, I've been promoted.
I'm not sure.
That's okay. I'm Manager of Youth and Family Services Programs for Community Education in St. Louis Park, and I feel privileged to be able to testify on behalf of Senate File 203, the Community Education Revenue Program funding increase from the current $5.42 per capita to $5.95 per capita. And this amount actually constitutes a return to the funding level set in 1987 by the legislature. So we're just asking you to bring the money back to where it was 20 years ago. Everyone in this room, all of our young people here with us today, and your constituents in your home communities, you are community education. Community education exists in all 342 school districts in Minnesota. The programs that you and your constituents ensure are available through a general levy and aid formula are an investment in the lives of all Minnesotans. Over 900,000 adults statewide participate in one or more adult education programs offered through community education in either their home or a neighboring community. 1.7 million youth are served through one or more of community education's programs. Nearly 200,000 children ages birth through five are served through one or more of community education's early education programming. By creating an environment that encourages all citizens, womb to tomb, to be part of lifelong learning and active citizens, community education ensures that each Minnesota community remains vital with energized citizen participants. Because you and your constituents are community education, you do this by maximizing resources. For every dollar of state levy and aid support, community education generates more than $4 in additional revenue, and I consider this an excellent return on your investment. Whether you or your neighbors attend an evening event at your child or your grandchild's or your neighbor's school, it is community education's facility scheduler who made sure that the custodians knew to open the doors that evening and to set up the chairs in the gym. The building monitor hired by community education for such events helps ensure that you all will be safe. Collaboration is a hallmark of community education. As Senator Latz mentioned, many community education programs work in tandem with the cities. Many senior citizen centers are organized, housed, and sustained through collaborative efforts and partnerships between community education and the city, community organizations, groups, and businesses. Research by William Morris of Decision Resources shows that participants in community education are better informed and they view their school district more positively than non-participants. Community education program users are strong supporters of referendum proposals. Thus, the positive impact of community education serves to significantly alter the community perception of its entire educational enterprise in a favorable manner. This happens because you and your constituents are community education. The Community Education General Levy provides the infrastructure for all community education programs. The levy allows each community to use its local resources to tailor programs to meet local needs. This is particularly critical at a time when demographics are rapidly changing in so many Minnesota communities, whether in outstate Minnesota or the metro area. The levy allows for community education to offer fee assistance and scholarships often required by school boards and community education advisory councils. In this way, the levy helps to even the playing field so everyone in the community has equal access to all learning opportunities. I just want to add here, yesterday I was overhearing our lead teacher in ECFE talk with a parent who was calling looking for a class, and she was looking for a preschool for her child. And what I heard her say in response was, well, we can make this affordable for you. And so we had someone who came to community education who was unable to pay a tuition in another facility, and I don't know where it was, but we were able to say to her without hesitation, she didn't have to put down the phone and look at me and say, can we do this? She knew she could do this because she is community education, and I think that's a real hallmark of what we do. In 1987, the legislature supported community education through the general levy and aid formula, which produced revenue of $5.95 per capita. The 2003 state budget cuts reduced this amount to $5.23. It was partially restored in fiscal year 05 to $5.42. Now, as you're all aware, if you go to the grocery store, costs for everything have increased in the past 20 years, and community education has not been immune to this. However, in the past 20 years, as funding has been cut to schools, cities, and other partners, community education has done what it can to continue to offer classes and programs. And as good as we are, we really have maxed out our ability to do more with less. One of my colleagues on the Minnesota Community Education Association's legislative committee says, we are doing less with less. That's where we're at. Another significant part of this bill addresses increasing the minimum amount a small district may receive to support community education program. And this impacts 56 school districts, primarily in Greater Minnesota. Community education directors in Greater Minnesota report that this is the most difficult budgetary period in their memory. The community education director in McGregor, Lisa Cruz, is a one-person department. She oversees ECFE, school readiness, adult basic education, the Community Fitness Center, the Intergenerational Resource Center, Driver's Ed, and the Big Sandy Water Institute. I also know she is the girls' basketball coach up in McGregor. She is responsible for maintaining and overseeing the budget, writing grants, submitting all state reports, collecting data, and assessing programs. Her message to you this morning is community education is vital to rural communities. So many important opportunities for youth and adults derive from community education. Raising fees is not an option when in McGregor, 66% of our families qualify for free and reduced lunch. Community education, in Lisa's opinion, is not an option for rural Minnesota. It is a necessary and vital component of the community and the school. Over the last 20 years, you and your constituents have contributed to the well-being and growth of every member of your community through community education. I know you have seen and felt the results of this powerful program as you campaigned and when you are in your home districts. I have the opportunity to see it every day. I see it in the faces of the learners at Central Community Center where I work. New babies and their mothers, both new arrivals in the United States, come to school together thanks to your support of community education of the Family Literacy Program. Mom is able to learn English while her baby receives high-quality care. In our preschool childcare room, I see it in the doll furniture that the seniors at Lenox Community Center made in their workshop for the children. Again, saving taxpayers money. They didn't have to buy the doll furniture. The seniors made it for them. After school, I see third graders skipping down the hall on their way from a youth enrichment class to their school-age childcare program. In the evenings and Saturdays, our gym is filled to capacity with community members from their 20s through their 70s playing basketball, taking jazzercise classes. We have a group of Pakistani men enjoying their weekly game of volleyball on Saturday mornings. You and your constituents make this happen. Please continue to support your community's lifelong learning by restoring the general community education formula from $5.42 to $5.95 per capita. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, that's our presentation. We're available for questions.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. O'Brien. I do agree. I think everybody agrees that the community education has a long reach in terms of our communities and affect a lot of individuals. And members, I was just looking at the participants over the years. It has grown a lot in the last number of years. In the budget book, there's a little history of the community ed over since 2000, so you can take a look at that. The explanation, I think, was very good that Senator Latz presented in terms of the budget, the cost. Anything else that Senator or Mr. Nauman you'd like to add?
Mr. Chairman, only that I would note that due to the effective date of the bill, there would have to be a double levy in 2008. Because of the effective date, we can't get the levies on the books until, correction, in Pay 08, Fiscal 09, there would have to be a double levy. We can't get the levy on the books until that year. So the district would have to back recognize the revenue into Fiscal 08. That's why there's a big balloon in the Fiscal 09 levy.
And Mr. Nauman, I think you also mentioned that if the committee decides to move ahead on this, that we would request a new fiscal note because it's based on the November forecast instead of the February forecast. So,
and Mr. Chairman, if the matter that Mr. Nauman has raised regarding the effective date is a problem, that can be adjusted as well.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Latz, it's not a problem. It's just a matter of note for the committee and yourself to think about. It's a $4.9 million levy impact in fiscal year 09, which is the levy for both fiscal 08 and fiscal 09 combined into a single year. It's the committee's pleasure whether they choose to go that route.
So as the committee and other committees get their kind of targets to work on, we'll keep that into consideration. It's always a balance of things, you know, like how much taxes do we kind of allow to occur and how much spending do we, you know, generate. And so it's kind of a balance. And as the committee gets their targets and everything, I think this is certainly a very strong area for our communities and constituents. So, Senator Clark, or would you like to move that? I don't think there's any amendments that we have to make. Senate file 203 be recommended, be laid on the table and recommended for possible inclusion in the Omnibus Education Act. And members and other members who are probably and those who are just here and listening, the process basically is to hear the request of the members that are presenting, and then what we as a committee are doing is laying the proposals on the table. And as we get closer to our budget and the amount that the E-12 Education Committee will be working with, both in aid and levy, then we'll start putting these proposals together and try to fit what normally is a much larger request than what we were able to meet. So all of the proposals that we'll hear today and this evening, as we have in the past, we'll be laying on the table for consideration, unless the committee decides not to do it at all. But, on Senator Clark's request, our motion to lay Senate File 203 on the table for possible inclusion, any questions or discussion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, the same sign. Motion is adopted. And I should have mentioned before we did that we do have a quorum, so let the record reflect. Thank you, Senator Latz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
Thank you.
We'll go back to Senator Therese Ray and Senate File 822.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to present Senate File 822 this morning. I do believe I have two people that will be presenting with me. I hope they are here. Ben Terry and Shelby Gibson. Thank you. We have some people leaving the room. Thank you. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, today I'm presenting Senate File 822. This bill will increase the youth service revenue from $1 per capita to $1.25 per capita. Community education offers youth programming to children ages kindergarten through 12th grade based on positive youth development principles such as academic achievement and leadership development. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, I feel very strongly that we need to increase the formula for youth programming. You will be hearing from me about this issue again and again, and also about parent participation. I think what has been important for me during this period, during the last 7 weeks in this office, is that I have been visited by many people throughout the state, particularly in my district, to really talk about the impact that youth programming has had. We have had, these programs have been cut severely, and our kids don't have access to after-school programming in the state of Minnesota. During the 2004-2005 school year, over 112,000 children received high school quality age child care through local community education programs. And we heard in the previous testimony from a director that talked about this. Community education also provided over 443,000 students with the opportunity for leadership development, enrichment, parent involvement, and community service programs through their youth development years. In addition, over 1 million elementary and secondary youth were engaged in positive after-school summer programs, which included tutoring, academic support, the arts, recreation, languages, and work skills preparation. I have two people with me today who will be able to talk about their experiences and the need to increase funding for this program. I have with me the principal from Northeast Middle School, Mr. Ben Terry, who will talk about this, and I also have a student, Shelby Gibson, who will be talking about her experience.
Hey, welcome. Thank you, Senator Therese Ray. And who's going to go first? Mr. Gibson?
I am, sir. Mr. Chair?
Ben Terry. Okay.
Senators, thank you for the opportunity to address you requesting additional funds for youth programs delivered across the state through community education. I am Ben Perry. They said Terry, but it's Perry. I'm principal at Northeast Middle School. During the 2004-05 school year, local community education programs provided over 443,000 students with opportunities for leadership development, enrichment, parental involvement, and community service through their community youth and youth service programs. An additional 1,019,284 elementary and secondary youth were engaged in positive after-school and summer programs, which included tutoring, the arts, recreation, language, work skill preparation, field trips, and more. After-school programs for youth offer a safe, constructive, and positive environment. The national research shows the youth program changed lives in the following ways. It increased academic achievement and greater engagement in learning, increased school attendance, better emotional adjustment and connection to school and community, reduced risk-taking behavior. I would like to share some thoughts on how I see youth responding to search after-school program offered through community education at Northeast. Participation in after-school program definitely correlates with better attendance and academic success. We also see better peer and teacher relationship and higher self-esteem in after-school participant. These students seem eager to take on leadership role. With those students, we also see more parent involvement. We have found that this is a group, that a student that is not afraid to take risks.
They also seem to have a greater sense of community. We see this demonstrated by their greater involvement in community service and service learning project. These students appear to be happier and adjusted to school life. Many of our students live in high crime areas. Their parents are understandably concerned with their safety when they are away from home. The after-school program provides a safe environment for our students to engage in enrichment activities and interact with their peers with positive adult role models. We have a population of students who are learning English as a second language. One of our after-school programs called Spanish-Speaking Academic Help provide a study group and academic assistance in Spanish. We also have very popular programs that combine academic and sports. In this program, college-age, high school-age staff assist instructors in mentoring and tutoring our middle school students. This is an excellent opportunity for students who struggle with reading skills to improve them as well. These are just a few examples of the value that after-school programs bring to Northeast Middle School, which promote healthy development for all our students. Just to add a note, about a couple of days ago, I had an opportunity to speak to one of the students in my office. And this particular student, the question that I asked, are you involved in any of the after-school programs? He says, yes, as a matter of fact, I'm involved in the community education program. And he went on to say, I say, well, that is excellent that you are. He went on to say that, he said, Dr. Perry, I'm so glad that we do have a community ed program because there's a lot of activities that is calling to my attention outside my neighborhood. And my mom would not allow me to go out in the neighborhood after school, and that there has been a lot of affiliation with gangs, and this is actually keeping me away from that type of environment. My school is a late start school in Minneapolis. We have three tiers, and students arrive at my school at 9:30. They're out at 4:00. That means that after school starts at like 4:15. Those students do not get on their buses until about 5:30. They make it home probably about 6:15. Then they have to do their homework. This is telling me that our program is definitely making a positive impact on our students. For students to get out of school at 4:00, and 200 students stays after school and make it home Monday through Thursday at 6:15, that is speaking volume. So the program is definitely a program that need to be supported. And the program has been running extremely well in Northeast the 4 years that I've been there, and all across Minnesota, community education need to be supported. I thank you for your time and commitment to our children. Thank you.
I'm an eighth grader at Northeast Middle School, and I've been involved in the community.
Could you give your name for the record, please?
Shelby Gibson.
Yeah, welcome, Shelby.
I've been involved in the Community Education Beacons program at Northeast for all 3 years that I've been there. And the classes that I have been in include debate, Red Cross Kid Care, which is a babysitting class, and currently I'm in guitar. And these classes have given me not only something to do after school, but like they have taught me skills that I'm going to carry on with me throughout life. Like debate has taught me better researching skills, better reading skills. It has taught me how to write speeches. It has really improved my public speaking, and it was a great experience for me. It's helped me learn a lot about what's going on with the world right now, and it's just something that I'm going to carry on with me through the rest of my life. And guitar has not only given me another hobby, but it's teaching me self-discipline and responsibility. And I feel that responsibility for my actions is really important, and I know that I've met a lot of friends through the Beacons program, and it's just a really great program to have with the schools because it gives us something to do after school instead of, like, just going home and watching TV or something, and we learn a lot from it, like life skills that we're just going to carry on with us for the rest of our lives. And they also provide classes that can help tutor us with our homework and keep us active, and it's just something to look forward to after school. So I also believe that it would almost improve the attendance of the student because they have something to look forward to after school. And, like, I know whenever I've been involved with Beacons and my attendance has been pretty much perfect for the last 3 years because I know that I don't want to miss my classes after school. So, and it just gives us something to look forward to after school. And it's really helpful in the fact that there's a lot of different options for us to, you know, choose from, and it's just a great program to have. And I know if we didn't have Beacons at Northeast, I'd just probably be going home doing my homework and watching TV or something. So it makes it so that, like, TV time and everything is cut down, and it's educational, so it's not just like we're, you know, sitting there and doing nothing after school. And it's just a great program to have because it just gives us something to do and it keeps us out of trouble. And with the rising of gangs and violence and stuff, I feel like the Minneapolis Public Schools need programs like these so that we can all get the education that we need so we can excel in life.
Thank you. It's good testimony. Senator Rowland.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Perry, how big is your grant, and has it been continuous, or how many years do you get it for at a time?
I would have someone else to speak on that. I'm the principal. I do not administer the grant, but I do have Mr. Jack Tambo, who is district representative for Minneapolis Public Schools.
Maybe pull up another chair and...
We can do it. Make it quick here. Jack Tambo, Director of Community Education for Minneapolis. At Northeast, it's about $100,000 annually at Northeast. And we combine resources with a lot of different funding sources, include community education and private fundraising and 21st century funding as well.
And the number of years?
We're in our fifth year, I think, on two successive 21st century grants. So with that, budget about that. Otherwise, the budget is quite a bit less.
Senator Roblin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And are the programs then free to all the students who want to participate, or is there a sliding fee scale or something?
Senator, yes. It is in the 21st century program. That's a requirement. And generally, it's in locations where it's in locations where generally we have high poverty schools, and Northeast is one of those. So thank you for the chair.
I'm going back to Shelby Gibson then. Are the attendance and participation going up?
I believe so, yes. I know that everyone that I know, including myself, that has Beacons classes after school, make sure that they go to school because otherwise they cannot participate in their classes. So I know that, you know, at Northeast, at least, the attendance has greatly improved with the Beacons program.
Okay, and Mr. Perry, have there been reductions in programs over the last several years of these kinds of programs?
We have been, Mr. Chair, we have been able to sustain our program at Northeast Middle School. And if I'm not mistaken, Minneapolis has also been able to sustain the programs.
Okay, so the request for additional money, and this would be both aid and levy. It's a combination of program. The request would be to try to address the increased need for more people to attend or more programs.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I'm going to turn this over to Mr. Tambo to explain more.
Okay, and if you could just give your name for the record, please.
It's Jack Tambo, Director of Community Education, Minneapolis Schools. We have had reductions over the past several years. We've had to eliminate some programs across the city. The program at Northeast Middle School has not been affected. We've kept that one intact, but we have eliminated other programs across the city, youth-based programs in school buildings, as a result of the unallotments that we've experienced.
Okay. Senator Roblin?
So do you also have athletic programs that you offer at the middle school, too? So there's how many students, what percent do you have staying after school besides those involved in this program? Are they involved in other areas, too?
Yes, we do. We're also affiliated with Minneapolis Public School athletic program. We offer girls basketball and boys basketball, in which we are in the state middle school finals.
So
for both girls and boys. And but we offer also football. We offer softball and baseball. And this year we're going to add intramural soccer as well.
Okay, that's nice to hear that the attendance in some organizations is growing instead of going the other way. Senator Scheid.
Mr. Chairman, if I might ask about your open enrollment, you're in the state finals for it's junior high, middle school. Tournament. Are any of those students on the team open enrolled?
Mr. Perry?
My motive is not to change that for them. My motive is the opposite. But so don't worry about how you.
No. As a matter of fact, we have only one student on the boys basketball team who is from Columbia Heights. And parents decided that they would like for him to come to Northeast due to the fact that we offer IB, International Baccalaureate Program. And also just to make reference to what Todd Shelby had indicated, our attendance rate at Northeast is 95% daily attendance rate. Wow. And we have to attribute that to the great community education program we have and also great parent involvement that we have as well.
Great. Congratulations. Well, Senator Therese Ray, I just would alert members that on the fiscal note, if you're looking for this in your budget books, it's actually part of the community education program levy. And I think it's on page 285. Where it starts, and there are several programs that actually 286, several programs that community education provides, and they're listed there. And one of them is the youth service or youth development, youth service, along with several other programs, and that's where that particular part of it would be found. Members. If you look on the fiscal note, you'll notice that for 2009, just as Senator the previous bill, there'd be a double levy in 2009 to cover for the 2008 and 2009. And that levy is
$6.6 million.
And the
Mr. Chairman, it's not obvious on the fiscal note under local government costs that there's language that suggests that there would be an adjustment needed, and that's sort of fiscal note speak for this double levy dynamic. Excuse me. We would be tracking $6.6 million in fiscal 09.
Okay. Any questions that members have? If not, Senator Therese Ray, would you like to make a motion?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, members of the committee. I would like to move that Senate File 822 be recommended for passage and refer to, I don't know where, to okay, be. Yeah. I don't would, have to refer it now. I was going to go to Senator Wigger's committee, so it's here now.
The motion would you'd lay it, recommend that it would pass, lay it on the table for possible inclusion in the E-12 education bill.
Finance so bill. Moved.
Okay, on Senator Therese Ray's motion, all those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed, the same sign. Motion is adopted. Thank you very much for your testimony and for you coming over and being part of the testimony. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, members of the committee.
Thank you so much.
Senator Michelle. Senate File 631.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. I'm excited to have Senate File 631 in front of this committee this morning. We're going to talk a little bit about the Minnesota Children's Museum, members. We are all working, especially members of this committee, working on the early childhood topic this year. And I think I'd submit to you today that the capital of early childhood learning is just down the street. Here in Minnesota. It's just down the street at the Minnesota Children's Museum. If you want to see the outcomes and impacts of early childhood learning, all you need to do is walk down the street. If you want to see the kind of things that Art Rolnick and Bob Brunix and the University of Minnesota are talking about, again, all you need to do is go down the street to the Minnesota Children's Museum. Mr. Chair and members, the focus of the Minnesota Children's Museum, for those of you who haven't been there, is on children from the age of 6 months to 10 years, which coincidentally is the age of my four kids. So I'll admit to spending a lot of time there. I've also been fortunate enough to be on the board of directors of this organization for the last couple of years. And another message that I want to stress to you today is that this is a statewide resource. It's more than just a building in downtown St. Paul. We have school groups that come to the Minnesota Children's Museum from 35 different counties throughout the state. 35 different counties, kids are getting on buses and coming to the Minnesota Children's Museum. So this is a great statewide resource and a treasure. State funding, members, is approximately 5% of the budget of the Children's Museum, and we'll get into those details in a little bit. And today's measure before you, Senate File 631, is looking for a $750,000 contribution in the next state funding in the next biennium. So I have with me today the president of the Children's Museum, Sarah Caruso. I also have Beckhoff. And Beckhoff from the Children's Museum, and we have some treasures, Mr. Chair. We have some treasures that Ann has with her. So I guess turn the microphone over to Sarah at this point for further discussion.
Thank you, Senator Michelle. Is it Sarah Caruso?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Please give your name for the record.
Welcome. I'm Sarah Caruso, president of the Minnesota Children's Museum, and I'd like to thank you for the opportunity to speak very briefly about the museum, and also to thank Senator Michel for his leadership and support, not only of our work, but his work on the bipartisan early childhood committee that I think is proving to be so useful to all of us who care about early childhood in the state. I'm just going to add to a few things Senator Michel said. Our attendance, our annual attendance, is 420,000 children and adults each year. And I stress the parent-child part of the visit. It's very hard to drive yourself to the museum if you're only 6 months or 10 years old or anything in between. And so we offer something that all early childhood educators know is so vital, which is that parent-child experience. The average length of stay at the museum is 3 hours, so indeed, and our satisfaction ratings are 95% from our visitors. So indeed, our visitors are spending a lot of time together in a very satisfactory environment. In addition to having school groups come from 35 counties in the state, I'm very proud to say that 85 of our 87 counties are represented by visitorship. So again, we are a true statewide asset. And you have a brochure, a small presentation that I'm not going to go through, but on the second page you can see the map of our great state, which depicts our statewide coverage. Two other quick things to highlight. We have very strong community partnerships. We work in depth with the St. Paul Public Schools. We work in depth with Head Start programs in Minneapolis, St. Paul, Anoka, and Washington counties. And we also have deep partnerships with the public library systems in Dakota County and St. Paul. So again, these community partnerships are very vital to our outreach program. Finally, I'd like to highlight what we call our access program. One-third of all visitors, of these 420,000 visitors, come to the museum at free or reduced admission. All school groups come on a sliding scale. We have a free Sunday program once a month, free third Sunday. We have several other library and membership programs. Of our 11,000 families who are members to the museum, 2,000 of those family memberships we give away free. So we work very hard to be accessible to all families in Minnesota, both through economic access and these community partnerships. I want to turn the microphone over, with your permission, Mr. Chair, to Dr. Ann Beckoff, who runs all of our learning programs at the museum. She has a very fancy title as Director of Education, Experience, and Evaluation. So she's really developing the education programs and exhibits at the museum. And one of the key components of this request is a new program called Pint Size Math and Science. And I'm going to let Dr. Beckoff explain that program and share with you some of the fun materials we'd like to bring out statewide.
Hey, thank you very much, Ms. Caruso. Ms. Beckoff, if you'd give your name for the record, please.
Yes, I'm Dr. Ann Beckoff. I'm Director of Experience Development and Evaluation at the Minnesota Children's Museum. And I'd like to share with you today some resources that we would like to offer to students throughout the state of Minnesota, particularly children in preschool through grade 3. We at the museum have classes for students, and we have workshops for preschool and primary teachers, and we also offer something called Learning Trunks. And we have a small program now with Learning Trunks, but we would like to be able to expand this program and make this a program available throughout the state of Minnesota at no cost to the individual teachers and school districts. And you're going to be receiving here just a description of how these learning trunks tie to two important sets of standards here in the state of Minnesota, both the Minnesota academic standards for kindergarten through third grade and also the Minnesota early childhood indicators of progress. And both of those two important documents are used in the development of all the educational materials that we have at the museum, both for our general visitors and then most specifically for our school and group visitors. And I have brought today an example of one of these learning trunks so that you can see what kind of resources we would like to offer. And we would be working with school districts and teachers to customize these trunks to fit the needs of the particular school district and their particular curriculum. And then we would be training some teachers to in the use of these trunks, and they can train additional teachers in their district. So it's a train-the-trainer kind of model. And so I'm giving you an example of one of the trunks that we have right now, and this would be the type of thing that we would be using with teachers and students throughout the state. This particular trunk that I brought today is about the forest, and since we're talking preschool and elementary, we're looking at Minnesota forest, not the rainforest, but the forest that children here would have more need to know and more knowledge about. And with each trunk, there is a whole set of lessons that go along with it and resources that teachers can have access to. And then the trunk is filled with all kinds of materials that really interest children and help them learn. And here are some examples of that. In this trunk on forests, we have a whole collection of items that deal with raccoons as one of the animals that live here in Minnesota. So we have, for example, a raccoon skull, which is something that teachers aren't going to be able to afford to buy or have easy access to, but we have these available so that they're authentic objects for children to use and can use these for scientific thinking, analyzing what kind of food would this animal eat based on looking at its teeth and looking at the structure of them. And we'll give you the opportunity to experience these authentic objects as well. We have raccoon fur here so that the children can really understand and feel and see what that's like.
That's nice, Mr. Chair.
Then we also provide materials that are very multidisciplinary. So children with different learning styles have an opportunity to appreciate the materials, and we also are building skills in a variety of ways. So, for example, in this trunk we have raccoon tails that can be used as costumes for children. So they can build language art skills by writing plays and developing stories and acting those out. We also have puppets so that children can develop puppet shows and practice performing those. So children who are interested in the arts have another way to connect with this science content. We also have some materials that really tie together lots of different areas. This is a particular book on nocturnal animals that live in the Minnesota forests, and it has a poem on each page and a small area that you can look in to try to identify what this animal is. So it's building on problem-solving skills, it's building attention to detail, and also giving them experience with poetry, and I'll turn close to the end here so you can kind of see how more and more clues are revealed to help the child see what, okay, thank you, what is there. We also provide materials where children can apply their science learning. So here we have a whole collection of tree blocks, they're called, so children can build their own forest. And then we have animals from the Minnesota forest to put in these environments so that they can see that these are the environments and these are the animals that live in the environment, and they can even put the animals in the correct place, that the bear can be in the tree and so on. And you can see how much more appealing this is than a worksheet that has a tree and lines that you draw from the animal to where they live. So we're really getting at that approach to learning, which is getting children curious and getting them interested in learning and providing materials that are really engaging for them. We also want to make sure that we tie the materials to literacy, and I'm being distracted here by the raccoon. So for each
of the concepts that are part of this science learning, we have both fiction and nonfiction books that are suitable for the ages of the children that we're talking about. For example, here is really a guide to types of trees and leaves in Minnesota at a primary and preschool level. Then we also tie that to fiction books. So children have the opportunity to listen to their teachers read these wonderful picture books that are available. This is one about a child who has a maple tree in her yard, and she's very interested in it and tells the story of this maple tree. So we both have this fiction and nonfiction combination to that. And then to support some of those activities as well, then we provide materials so that each child in the classroom has materials to use. Excuse me. For example, then we have a variety of leaves that children can use and figure out what kind of leaf it is by looking in the guides. So they're using some of that scientific process that we are building on to really build science skills as they get older. And the last piece I want to show you, I think, is one of the most interesting ones. Part of the concepts for early science is studying about the food chain and about predator-prey relationships and whether animals are omnivores, herbivores, or carnivores. So to help them do this, we have cards for each child with different animals on them. And it does say whether the animal is an omnivore or an herbivore or carnivore on the back, because that's not really the point that they memorize what they are, but it's to help them understand what they eat. So here we have an omnivore, which is a mole, and the children take their cards to the Big Woods Cafe, and at the Big Woods Cafe are slices of food that have different pictures of different things that the animal might eat, and they find a slice that matches what their animal would eat. For example, this mole is an omnivore because it eats plants and animals, so there's centipedes, earthworms, and fungi on here. So you can see how the children then can apply the learning that they've had using these interesting materials. So these are the kinds of resources we would like to offer the children of Minnesota and their teachers, and have the opportunity to come to the museum and work with us to develop these kinds of materials that they can use in their own classroom. Thank you very much for your time.
Senator Bonhoeff.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do have a few questions, but it does bring back memories. My children are now age 22 to 16, and I spent a lot of time at the Children's Museum over on Energy Park Drive when they were younger and did birthday parties. And so it's wonderful to have you here, and I must say your materials are engaging for all of us. We were very engaged as they came around the table. How does this appropriation, and I am a co-author on the bill, so I do support it, but how does this appropriation differ from what we've done in the past?
Mr. Nauman?
Mr. Chair, Senator Bonhoeff, in the Department of Education appropriation, there is $260,000 set as a set-aside as an annual appropriation to the Children's Museum.
Senator Bonhoeff?
Yeah, thank you. Okay, and then my other question was, actually as a follow-up to that one, so is this an additional appropriation because you're increasing the programming or you're increasing the percent that's coming from the state? What's the...
The additional request is to fund specifically this pint-sized math and science statewide program.
Thank you, and then... One more question was,
Senator Bonner.
Do you have a relation, thank you, Mr. Chair, a relationship with the Science Museum? I know they're doing, I'm sure you have some relationship, but I know they offer programs in some of these areas. How do you collaborate together?
Well, Eric Jolly and I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. Eric Jolly and I are obviously colleagues and friends. We do not have a formal relationship on this program. Their age target is quite a bit older than ours. And our specialty working with the very young children is, I think, distinctive and important because, as you saw in many of these materials, A child does not have to be able to read to succeed and learn at the Minnesota Children's Museum. And in addition, our focus is very much on this hands-on learning style, which developmentally we know is very appropriate for the preschool and early elementary ages. And so everything we do is very much designed to be developmentally appropriate for the younger children, which is a very distinctive aspect of what we offer.
Thank you.
If I could just follow up a little bit on Senator Bonhoff's question, is the request that you have in your proposal is it $375,000 over and above the base that you're requesting?
No, the total request for the biennium is $375,000 per fiscal year for a total of $750,000 for the biennium.
Okay, so that comes to about $115,000 increase per year.
Per year, yes, which we would use to fund the pint-sized math and science.
All right. Okay. Any other questions that members have? Senator?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. I don't remember how many pints are in a quart, but I guess how much do we have to fund this to get a quart-sized program? Maybe I need to put it in front of you. My question, Mr. Chairman, is I'm just curious because I don't know, is an appropriation that we make from this committee on this, does this come out of targets, or is this a separate thing? Does this count as part of the K-12 budget, or is this separate?
No. What's in the existing base, in other words, the existing funding, is $260,000 per year. And I think the governor's recommendation was for that to continue, right, the existing base. And Senator Michelle's proposal would be to add $115,000 per year to that base, which would then it would come to $375,000, and that does come out of our target. And and I'm presuming that you would reestablish a new base, which would be $375,000. Is that your intent?
I think that would be wise, Mr. Chair.
Okay, so
build this in. This is not a one-time vision from the Children's Museum.
Okay,
this
so it would be an ongoing, a new base. Okay, and so that would come out of our existing target.
Okay, thank you.
But Mr. Chair and Senator Gerlach, I was a little nervous when we started talking about the pint-sized math program because, of course, I thought they'd need a pint-sized legislator to carry it. So I guess that's me.
Okay. Senator Gerlach, do you want to make a motion on this?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I'll move this bill.
All right. Senator Gerlach, any other questions that members have? Senator Gerlach moves that Senate file 631 be laid on a table for possible inclusion in the omnibus E-12 education finance bill. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, the same sign. The motion is adopted.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Michelle. And, we still have some of your things going around the table, so please don't leave before you get them. We have Senator Therese Ray. It must be Senator Therese Ray Day today. I see some others on the list. Senate file 853. Welcome back.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, members of the committee. I think I have two more bills for today, so thank you for giving me the opportunity to present these two bills. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, before I begin my testimony, I would like to ask, I need to move an amendment to put this bill in the shape that I need it for the hearing. So I think you have a copy of my amendment. This is just a technical amendment. I think it was distributed or is being distributed now.
I believe the amendment is
it's coming on.
Handed out or is being handed out. And members, we do not have a fiscal note on this particular bill yet, so just to let members know if they're digging through their pile of paper to try to find the fiscal note, we don't have one yet. Senator Terrasre.
Thank you.
Senator Terrasre moves the A1 amendment to Senate File 853. And I believe all the members have that. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, the same sign. The motion is adopted. Senator Terrasre.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I am here today with some very special people that will speak about this particular bill, but I'm very proud to be here before you presenting this bill. Senate File 853 will allow immigrant students who have arrived late in their academic careers to continue their education in a public high school or alternative learning center beyond the age of 21, up to a year in which they will turn age 23. Some of the committee members heard something similar yesterday from a proposal from Senator Linda Berglund. And what this bill does is creates an exception to the current law, which ends service at the age of 21 for the few students who arrived in this country late in their academic career and with interruptions in their academic careers due to their immigration journey. I have some people who will be able to speak about their experience today, and I think I will turn this to them so that they can you can ask questions directly from them and really learn firsthand about their experiences and the need to give students this opportunity. So first I have
my name is Carol Dahlman.
Thank you.
I'm a teacher at Wellstone International, and thanks for the opportunity to tell our story. Before I start, I'd like to give the students and staff at LEAP, also in St. Paul, a chance to introduce themselves.
My name is Sitama. I'm from Cambodia.
Welcome.
I'm Asha Mohammed. I'm from Somalia.
Welcome.
My name is Carmen Pacheco, and I'm from El Salvador.
Welcome.
My name is Rose Santos, and I'm the principal of International Academy LEAP, a St. Paul Public High School. That's alternative program for international students.
My name is Dek Salad, as a DEEQ, and I'm from Somalia, and I came here 2004. Thanks.
Thank you.
My name is Kalifala Dukli. I'm from Liberia.
And we are here today because these students feel an urgent need to graduate from high school as soon as possible, go on to finish college, and they know that in order to do this and support their families, and in order to do this, they have to have a good education. The problem is that when they reach age 21, there's no appropriate program for them. They're too old to be in high school, so we can't keep them. And yet the adult ed programs are designed for adults who are older than they are, and so those programs are part-time. And they don't want part-time school, they want full-time school. In fact, they want more than full-time school. I believe every single one of these students has gone to summer school or after-school programs in addition to the regular school day, or sometimes both, summer school and after-school programs. Adult Ed offers GED, but the reading level required for GED is too high for such recent immigrants. They'll be at that reading level when they graduate, but they're not necessarily at that level when they're age 21. And we don't even have enough of these students to start a new adult ed program, because even in the entire Minneapolis public schools, there's probably 30 to 40 at the most, and most likely fewer than that. So it's not enough to start their own program. The problem is that when these students reach the age limit, some of them see that there's no way they can graduate by 21 and they drop out. Others stay with us as long as they can. We try to transition them to adult ed, but find that they've disappeared after a few months and they haven't finished. Sometimes they come back to visit and they tell us that they're working, they've left education, they're working low-skill, low-wage jobs, even though they were doing very well the year before and they were good students. This bill will help these students stay in school, finish high school sooner, and go on to college and help support their families, because that's their goal. They want to educate themselves first, mentor their younger brothers and sisters, so and pave the way for them to go on to college. They want to support their parents because they know very well that their earning power is most likely going to be much greater than their parents. And in time, they'll have their own children to support. So they are going to be supporting three generations in just a few short years. And they're eager to start as soon as possible. And I have here an article, which I'll leave with Senator Torres Rey, about the number of Americans in deep poverty. It's from the Star Tribune a week ago Saturday. The number of Americans living in deep poverty is going up. It's going up faster in Minnesota than any other state, as you probably know. And that increase is attributed to increases among recent immigrants. And the students we brought with us today and the ones we left back at school are the ones, those are the people who can help reverse this, because they're prepared to take on the responsibility of supporting their families just as soon as they can. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Dahlman.
Hi again. My name is Asha Mohammed. I'm one of the Wellstone students. I came here in 2005, September, and I started my school at Wellstone. Before that, I was a refugee in Kenya, and I got some opportunities to go to school, but it was not enough to complete my high school. And my English speaking skills was low. And after I started at Wellstone, it helped me a lot to build up my English skills so that I can dream into a good future. In Africa, when we were in Kenya, we were having a lot of problems, and which does not accept us to finish our school because of financial and, you know, the refugee in Kenya is totally different about the refugee in United States, because we didn't get this opportunity to go to school for free. And my family was 9, and I was the only one who got that opportunity to go to school. And I'm still dreaming that I will be the only one who go to university and help them. But when I get here, the age was limited, like 21, although I was not yet 21, but I have seen that my brothers and sisters can get this opportunity to go to school or to build up their skills from high school to college. So I would like to ask you that, I'm asking you that to give us this opportunity so that we can take advantage of it, and we can be a good citizen and who can help their parents and don't bother to from the government to get support, so that we can support our people, ourselves, and our futures. We want to be productive. We want to be a good citizen. So I would like this bill to be passed so that we can be a productive people to the United States. Thank you.
Thanks. Can I just refocus the discussion here for just a second? The legislation, Senator Tresre, that you have relates to contract alternative programs. Is that correct?
Okay.
And there's, I don't know exact number. Okay.
Chairman, I need salt on that.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, I'm Mary Gilbert from the St. Paul Public Schools. The amendment, the bill actually was a bill that was introduced last year, and the title was not changed when the bill was introduced, and that's part of the amendment. So this bill, we tried to very, very narrowly focus to the group of students that you're talking to today, because we understand that money is tight and there is a fiscal cost. So this bill addresses students that have very limited education in the country because they're new. They have to achieve or be able to reasonably achieve their diploma by the time they're 23. And they have to be in a special program. So we tried very, very hard to not open this bill up to a wide group of kids, that we were trying to address a specific niche with this bill. And so the amendment should have cleaned up some of the language. It was pointed out to us in the House that it still was too broad. And so I believe the department is redoing the fiscal note based on the amended language of this bill and not the bill as it was introduced. So I do apologize, because the title actually made it very confusing. So,
Ms. Gilbert, that was really my train of thought, too,
yeah.
Is that just who does it apply to? And I'm not real clear. We don't have a fiscal note on this, so we're not entirely sure what costs we're working with. But question is does this also include special education?
Mr. Chairman, that was exactly the concern we had. This bill, again, is drafted specifically with this amendment so that it would be to limited English proficient students that will have eight years or less of education. Most special education students are eligible from birth on. We were again trying to very narrowly craft this so it would not become a new entitlement.
Okay. And the question would be, under the existing practice, what does St. Paul do with these students, and where do they go?
Mr. Chairman, that's a very good question. Under the last couple of years, there used to be funding for an adult diploma program, and so students used to move from the K-12 system into an adult diploma program, but that unfortunately was one of the programs that was cut over the last couple of years under the budget cuts. And we have tried to accommodate some of these kids in our ABE program, but as the testifiers have said, that program is part-time and generally has adult students. And unfortunately, in that program, there is a humongous waiting list there as well. And so the need for these kids has far outstripped the resources that have been provided.
Thank you, Ms. Gilbert. Okay. I think we, Senator Scheid.
Mr. Chairman, if I might clarify, then the students who are 22 and over 21, 22 up to 23 would still be in the school. Am I correct? It's not to be contracted. I shouldn't look at the title.
No, no. Yeah, Mr. Chairman and Senator Scheid. Again, in Minneapolis, and we've been trying to contact, you know, to find out what happens in other states, in other cities. For example, I know in Rochester, the Somali students tend to go until they're 21, and then they're kind of disappearing as well, you know, that once the services aren't available. In Minneapolis, the students attend at a Wellstone, which is a physical high school. In St. Paul, it's an area learning center. The LEAP Academy is one of our area learning centers. So the two programs that would be eligible under this bill would be a high school that served this specific population or an area learning center that served this specific population.
Senator Scheid.
Mr. Chairman, if I might, and I just, I think I maybe don't have the numbers with me, but I do a lot of substitute teaching at Brooklyn Center High School, and I know of students who turned 21 and were not going to finish. In fact, in my address book in here, in my calendar, I have the written note of a young man's address, so I could tell him what he could do, and what he could do was try to get into a very crowded adult basic ed program, which was no cost to him, I believe, but I think that he wasn't able to get in because it was so full. and it wasn't exactly, it wasn't within that, in the school district. I wanted to tell you that this is just interesting. In Hennepin County, of students who come, of among immigrant and refugee families in Hennepin County who speak an African language at home, 62% live in Brooklyn Center and Brooklyn Park, the district I represent. Among those families who speak an Asian language at home, more than 70% live in those two communities, particularly Brooklyn Center. It's an amazing need out there. And one of the things I do a lot of sub work in, because I had training when I was a Peace Corps volunteer in teaching English as a second language, and that's my favorite, my very favorite class. And I would tell the young woman from Kenya, she comes from a beautiful country. I've visited there several times in my lifetime, and it's amazing the disruption in people's lives that's happening in many of the countries where we have immigrants coming from. So this is just a really strong need, and I hope that we do this.
And Mr. Chairman and Senator Scheid, what we found out with the new immigrant populations is that you have to create a certain economy of scales to actually have the programs in place. So there has to be like a critical mass to actually do a service for these kids. So what we found out is that kids even that move to some of the suburban districts after they've immigrated actually end up open enrolling back in to take advantage of both a program like this in Minneapolis or St. Paul. And so we do work with our suburban neighbors on that, or for the transitional learning centers that are located in our other high schools, because when these kids come, these families come, in addition to, you know, getting used to our weather, there's been a lot of health issues and a lot of just culture shock related to that and mental health issues, and so we do set up these transitional learning centers that provide the kind of support that, frankly, a lot of districts can't support, and so that's why we are trying to, provide some service, for these families. We didn't go out and recruit them. We love having them. We celebrate the diversity, and they're here. And so we feel like we have an obligation to serve them in the best way we can.
Ms. Gilbert, just one other question. How did your adult diploma program run? Was that in the school, or how was that designed?
Mr. Chairman, the adult diploma program ran through our area learning center as well. We actually operated a day and an evening high school. So for kids, again, that had some work or family obligations during the day, we actually offered some of those classes in the evening as well. And so now we do actually have our LEAP program starts at 10 o'clock. It's a late start school.
It seems to me that the committee will have to decide, but there's two ways of going. One is the way that you're trying to address it and figure out how you can kind of contain it within a within the existing general education system. And what you mentioned is the adult diploma program, which would be kind of alongside of or in addition to that. And I'm just thinking that maybe we'll have to have a little discussion as to which is the best approach, because I think the need is there, obviously. It's just how do we make it available without kind of getting it tangled up in other things. So
Mr. Chairman, we share exactly those same concerns. So we, again, that's why we were trying to focus it on a very limited population. And maybe we don't have it exactly right. We thought we did, but...
Okay. Well, I think we got an idea. I don't have an idea, but I think we got an idea of what the problem is and what we're trying to get at. So, okay. Senator Therese Ray.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. I think the issue with all of the issues related to immigration and education really have to do sometimes with age. And here, I'm going to be presenting the adult basic education bill in just a moment. which answers some of the questions you have. But I think part of the issue here is providing these young adults an opportunity to receive intense education so that they can move on with their education. And I think that's, I think the struggle right now in trying to figure out what is the best setting so that they can move. They have the time to do it. They are young. They can learn really fast. And so intensity is so important during this age. And when you really try to put, you know, people this age in adult education programs, they are right now not funded. They are limited. So I think that's the issue we're struggling with. But, of course, the committee will decide what will be the best approach.
One thing. If I could add one thing, we'll continue to work with Mr. Chair. If we will, no matter what happens with this bill, we would continue to work with adult ed because this bill would not cover all of our students. There are students who have much longer than 2 years to go, and those students will transition to adult ed. But the difficulty adult ed has is that by the time they do get to the higher level, we've got some students who need geometry, some need algebra 2 to prepare for college. We've got some who need science credits, some who need social studies, and it's very hard for adult ed to have enough students to meet their specific needs and graduate them quicker.
Ms. Dahlman, I think we understand that. I think these are separate programs. It's just the concern I think some of us have is that we understand the situation, but I think it might best be solved by going to something that goes alongside of our traditional education system. I haven't worked through all the details in my mind, but by changing the basic structure, it's sometimes very difficult to contain it. And visiting with Ms. Gilbert, I think they realize too the problems that you start getting into, and so I think what we want to do is try to address the problem and take care of it in the best way we can without kind of redesigning the bigger system. So.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right. Senator Therese Ray, you want to make a motion, or do you have other more testimony?
Would you like to say a few words? Thank you, Mr. Chair. Again, my name is Deir Salad, and I am from International Academy Leap Schools, and I am a student council member. 25 days from now, I will be 21 years old, and today I represent for students, especially immigrant students who are 21 and over, and have the problems to graduate or get their diploma. First of all, 3 years ago, I applied at high school in one of the St. Paul public schools, and before I started the school, I had a conversation with my counselor that we talked about my graduation, and he told me that I will graduate in 2008, by the time I will be 22 years old. That time, and he also told me that I will not be able to get because of being 21 years old. So I left that school and I came to International Academy Lab School, and I had the same conversation with my counselor in Lab again. And he told me that if I do my best and just attend summer schools and do some other extra credits, and just only concentrate about school, I will be able to graduate in 2007. That made me happy, and I really did, and I only concentrate, and I promised myself not to do anything else but going to school. Even though I knew my parents, my family with 11 people needed my support, they only get one income, and there are 11 people, and they only get one income. And they really needed my support to support their income and their needs, but I did not apply a job because in order to get that diploma and to get my dream through college and to be success. After so many months, and I did so hard, and my teachers in LEAP did work with me in order to get my credits, and I actually made it, and I will be graduating this June. But, however, there are a lot of students who are like me, who really have that problem of being 21, but and also have a lot of dreams to get through college and get better jobs and get being a very good leader as you are. But the problem is that when they turn 21 years old, they will be eliminated and they will be forced to leave the school. And that's what made a lot of people hopeless, or what made a lot of students and give up from college, from being success. In 2005, last year, our school almost dropped 50% of the students who were 21 and over. They dropped, and they did not even try the other adult programs, because first of all, one of the reasons is that those students had families, they have children, most of them. They had support. They were not lucky as like me because of having my family and I didn't have to pay rents or get jobs. But they did have that. They have to get their own jobs and pay their rents and support their families. Though that's why they had to work and study. Also, those students couldn't go to college, the adult program, because, first of all, it gives 3 hours of schooling each day, which that is instead of 6 hours from high school. And also, when they graduate from that school and they took their time from that school, from the adult, they will not receive as a diploma. They receive a GED. That's what made them not even to choose or get that. And right now, this year, we have the same students in our school. I have them in the same classes, which if you see like their eyes, you can see their tears, and they are ready to learn and to get and to be success, but they don't have the ability even to get a graduate or diploma. So that's why they make them hopeless or being not even support their families. Even without diploma, there are a lot of trouble that they cannot get the jobs they want, because a lot of jobs that require to have a diplomas or anything that would make you from high school or something like that. So right now the students are waiting. They have only one hope, that they will wait to lead them their dreams. And thank you very much.
Thank you for that very touching testimony. And, you know, I think the committee, and I can't speak for every member here, but I think we want to try to find a solution, and one that will help you achieve whatever dreams you might have. So I'm committed, and I think other committee members are too. We'll work on it. We'll try to come up with the very best solution that we can and keep you in school so you can get your diploma and go on to college or do whatever you'd like to do. That's what we'd like to see you.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, as you can imagine, this is really something that is so important to these young adults, and I
have Carmen here, who has really prepared her testimony and who was ready to present that to you. So I hope that's okay. I know you want to move, but I would like to give her the opportunity to speak sure. to you.
My name is Carmen Pacheco. I want to thank you all for the opportunity of being here and for the opportunity of letting me represent my school. I'm here like my other student that was here, representing all the students that are over the age of 21 years old and that are not able to graduate yet. I'm here to ask you guys for your help, because it's very important for us to graduate and get a high school diploma. Some of the students in the school need at least one more year of school in order to graduate. One more year will really make a very big difference in our life. It's very important for us to be able to graduate and get a diploma. Me, as an example, I'm a mother. I got two kids, and in order to support my kids with a better life, I really need to have a better job. And it's for that I really need to continue, finish my high school, get a diploma, and continue with college. And you guys have the opportunity of providing us the opportunity of continuing. We want to let you know that if you guys, I'm sorry, but if you provide us the opportunity of continue high school, we will make the best of us. We will take advantage of it. We will be good students. And we are already a good student. We're attending to school. Our grades are good. I don't want to say that they're excellent, because having English as a second language is very difficult sometimes. But we are trying the best we can. We don't cause any trouble to the school. Like the other students say, some of us are already involved in student council, service council. We're helping the school, and that makes us see as the seniors of the school. We are just asking for a chance, one more chance, so we're able to finish school and get a high school diploma. Thank you.
Thank you very much. It's really quite gratifying to hear the testimony, and and very touching. So thank you. Senator Therese Ray.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would like to, if this is the time, I don't know if the members have any more questions for any of the witnesses or.
Senator Wieger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Senator Torres Ray. That was just a great presentation. And you mentioned earlier, Senator Berglund had the opportunity yesterday evening to present a similar bill. We had some of the same testifiers, and you're asking for hope. I sure hope we can deliver on that for you, and I'm so impressed. Mr. Chair, they touched on their dreams, and if the students want, could they just say what that dream might be career-wise?
Just quickly say what you want after you graduate.
Yes, I am graduating this June, and I'm going to the University of Minnesota. Especially, I got accepted at Carlson School of Management, and that's what I want to do.
Great.
My dream is to become a doctor.
Oh, wonderful.
Actually, I have a dream that I had dreamed so many years before, even when I was when I did not come to the United States before. And it was like being like an architect. So that's why I'm looking through art.
Great.
Hi again. I have a dream that in the future I become a nurse.
Okay. Great. Isn't that nice to hear all those dreams? We have some others too.
Yes. Go ahead. I do criminal justice.
Wonderful. Great. Well, thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. If this is the time, I would like to move to present a motion. I would like to move that Senate File 853 be laid for over for possible inclusion in the Omnibus Finance Bill.
Senator Therese Ray moves that Senator File 853 as amended be laid on the table for possible inclusion in the omnibus education bill. On that motion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, the same sign. Motion is adopted. Thank you very much, Senator Therese Ray, and all
thank
those
you.
That came to participate and testify. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, members of the committee.
What I'd like to do, pardon?
Thank you, and I think I have to stay here because I have another one coming right
well,
next on the
Senator
agenda,
Therese
but I don't know,
what I'd
Mr.
like
Chairman.
To do is I'd like to jump down to Senate File 1175, if that would be okay.
Absolutely.
And ask Senator Rummel if she would testify. And then after Senate File 1175, then I would like to take up Senate File 894. There are people there, and then we'll get back to yours. Okay, Senator, Senator Rummel.
Right.
I hate to mention this. As you're getting prepared there, but we're squeezed a little bit for getting our agenda done, so any of them that we can't get to will have to roll into this evening's agenda. I think members probably got that feeling anyway. So, Senator Rummel?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm pleased to be here to present Senate File 1175. I have with me witnesses Mr. Bob DeBoer from A Chance to Grow Minnesota Learning Resource Center, Stacy DeCourcy, Principal Jordan Elementary Schools, and Deborah Lewis and Luana Greenski from St. Louis County Schools. The bill you're about to hear is a bill that falls into the realm of those interventions that we've been talking about throughout the session so far. The things that help us advance children's learning. One of the ironic things is when this group of citizens came to me asking about this bill, I had a connection with them. I won't tell you how many years ago it was, but when I was a freshman in college, my psychology professor was actually doing research on the very intervention that they're going to describe to you. So when you listen to the description of how this intervention works, imagine a freshman in college doing some of these exercises. It was very intriguing to me that during the 90s, in the era of all the brain research, the work that was done way back 30-some-odd years ago, maybe even longer than that, is now come to a point that it's in our schools. So without further ado, I'm going to turn the microphone over to Mr. DeBoer, who will explain the two parts of this bill.
Thank you,
Welcome, Mr. DeBoer, if you give your name for the record, please.
Thank you, Chairman Stump. My name is Bob DeBoer, co-founder of A Chance to Grow at New Vision School. New Vision School is the charter school that developed some of these interventions, and in response to teachers asking for greater training in these areas, we approached the legislature to create the Minnesota Learning Resource Center. And the Minnesota Learning Resource Center focuses on training teachers from teams of teachers from schools around the state. And in your package, you'll see some of the communities we've worked in and the cost savings and the results. Given the limited time, we want to spend most of our time with testimony from some of the educational professionals who are actually working with the Minnesota Learning Resource Center. What we're specifically asking for is a restoration of our budget from the cuts that were experienced in the last biennium, and also an addition of funding to our work with Head Start centers. We're starting to work with Head Start centers in the Mojave area with around the White Earth Reservation in Anoka and Washington counties. And so with that, it's always important to make me brief. So I will pass the microphone over to the professionals who have been working with the Minnesota Learning Resource Center.
We have with us Stacy DeCourcy, principal of Jordan Elementary School.
Hi.
Could you give your name for the record, please?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Stacy DeCourcy. I'm the elementary principal at Jordan Elementary in Jordan, Minnesota. 3 years ago today, my teacher started working with the Minnesota Learning Resource Center and using the SMART techniques. SMART is a program developed by MLRC that helps develop fine and gross motor skills, improve visual tracking, and stimulate auditory processing in students. During the first year, 10 of my teachers dedicated 30 minutes a day to the SMART activities. After the first year of implementation, we saw dramatic results, and I'd like to share those with you. Using the SLOSAN-ORA reading test, we gathered pre- and post-data. We found that our third-grade students started the year with 52% reading at grade level. After four months of using the SMART techniques, our data showed gains for all students and a total reading proficiency in third grade of 90%. It's pretty dramatic. In kindergarten, we used the Brigance word recognition list to assess students. In the fall, our data showed only 33% proficiency. In the spring, we saw improvement with all of our students making gains and 86% of our students being proficient. Needless to say, after our first year, the rest of my staff wanted to know more. Jordan Elementary now has 24 teachers trained in using the SMART techniques. We have also become kind of a site to visit for surrounding schools. Prior Lake, Shakopee, Le Sueur, Belle Plaine, New Prague, Montgomery, Zumbrota have all come to visit our program and see what it's all about. More than test scores, I want to share the excitement, energy, and renewed dedication to education that my teaching staff now has, thanks in large part to what we're doing with MLRC. Their monthly mentoring and support has been invaluable to my staff. Here are some of the comments that my teachers have shared. Gwen Schultz is a third-grade teacher, and she told me yesterday, "I found that SMART Room activities have increased the academic ability of my students. I have also noticed a definite difference in concentration and attention to detail when we attend the SMART Room on a regular basis. Students are able to stay on task for longer periods of time. The kids love it." Amanda Wormerskirchen, third-grade teacher, says, "I've seen SMART techniques help my students in the area of math. The bilateral movements that I'm teaching students seem to help them make connections and memorize multiplication facts much quicker." Shannon Aukus, a kindergarten teacher, says, "I see the visual tracking and visual stimulation activities are so helpful in preparing students for being able to read. I've learned so many neat activities from our monthly mentoring meetings." This is my favorite. Cindy Lind has been teaching for 30 years in Jordan, and she says, "I was skeptical of anything new, including the SMART training. After a year of using the techniques, I can now say that spelling, math, and handwriting skills have never been better in first grade. The SMART Room is fun and motivating for kids. They don't even know they're learning." The state of Minnesota has raised the bar, and in response to this, schools have been asked to look at educational process in new and creative ways. I believe that our partnership with MLRC has had a tremendous impact on how we implement and deliver curriculum at Jordan Elementary. MLRC team has been insightful, supportive, and accessible to my staff, and we look forward to working with them into the future. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Corsi.
Deborah Lewis. Deborah Lewis will testify next.
Mr. Chair, I'm Deborah Lewis. I'm an Indian Education Coordinator for St. Louis County Schools, and I work with the Boost Up program in the Cherry School in particular. Cherry School is a pre-kindergarten through 12th grade very rural school in Iron, Minnesota. We're located approximately halfway between the towns of Hibbing and Virginia on the Iron Range. 365 students attend Cherry School, with 181 of those students being in the elementary. And we've been able to touch 111 students with the Boost Up program, either in their regular school day or in the supplemental programs that we offer. St. Louis County Schools Department of Indian Education is a supplemental program funded through the Title VII Act of the No Child Left Behind and the State of Minnesota Department of Indian Education Success for the Future grant. Smart Boost Up has been a great addition to the Cherry School curriculum. It provides for an alternative learning environment in a positive play-like atmosphere that supports developmentally appropriate instruction. Parents and teachers alike appreciate the program's influence on behavior and school readiness. Our programs include after-school, summer, kindergarten through third grade, and four-year-old components. All of our instructors implementing Boost Up curriculum have been trained by the MLRC, and as a mentor school, we receive continued supports with site visits, which is very important. 45 students have benefited from supplemental Boost Up programs sponsored by St. Louis County Schools Indian Education Programs, along with students who participate at the K through 3 level during the school day.
Thank you, Ms. Lewis.
Finally, we have with us Luana Greenski, Director of the Indian Education.
Hello. My name is Luana Greensky.
Thank you.
Thank you. All right. I'm the Director of Indian Education for St. Louis County Schools in northern Minnesota. And in the fall of 2006, our district tested students with the Northwest Evaluation Association MAP testing. The second and third grade combined classrooms at Cherry School as a whole scored 5 points above grade level medium in reading, and 20 out of the 26 students performing at or above proficiency. The same students scored 4 points above grade level medium in math, with 17 out of the 26 proficient or above. The students' testing scores did not coincide with past achievement levels noted by the teachers, and we attribute this better performance to the Boost Up or SMART curriculum that we have supplemented in this school. This spring, the students will be reassessed in MAP testing, and we'll be looking forward to seeing their results. So our program will be, you know, tested in data and all the things that we need to be documenting. Anecdotally, teachers wish they had known about SMART Boost Up curriculum at the beginning of their careers. The program validates their intrinsic knowledge that students learn more effectively when they're active. Pre-K teachers state that Boost Up activities promote kindergarten readiness. Parents and students are happy to participate in the alternative learning experience. The SMART Boost Up program through the MLRC has given us a chance to provide a developmentally appropriate supplemental program through two key ingredients: excellent training and continued mentorship, which we feel is very, very important for the sustainability of any program in our schools.
Mr. Chair, I'm going to ask
Senator Rummel.
Ms. DeCourcy to describe some of the exercises and things that are part of the program so that you have an idea of what's happening. This is very different from what we're used to.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. We've referred to SMART and Boost Up. It's one and the same. It's not necessarily a separate curriculum. It's just a teaching strategy and a way to incorporate fine and gross motor activities into the classroom. We know that kids are coming to us more and more. They don't climb trees and they don't build forts, and they aren't doing a lot of crossing the midline activities that we used to do. And so that visual tracking from left to right and the ability to sit and stay on task, it's more and more difficult. And we find that these activities, once we've incorporated them into the classroom, we're just seeing some real gains with kids. And, you know, they're able to sit and stay on task for longer periods of time, which enables us to present more curriculum. And my teachers love it, and the kids love it, and it seems to have really energized things. And we appreciate the support from MLRC. So,
going back to the legislation, Senator Rummel, and this probably would maybe Mr. DeBoer or Ms. Greensky, you mentioned the existing, the current appropriation is $160,000. That's the in the governor's recommendation. And your legislation has $325,000, and I believe, Mr. DeBoer, you mentioned that this goes back to what the at some point in previous years, that's what the appropriation either was or close to it. Is there what part is an ongoing, when you go to the school district and you train the teachers, does it become a self-sustaining program, and so the existing base moves so that you go to school district A and that school district adopts those practices and that approach, and after a year or two or whatever, those teachers become acquainted with that and can continue to use it, you move on to another district. Now, what this is more than double what you're currently receiving. So, I mean, can you give us a little more of an insight into what that would mean?
Yes, Chairman Stump and Senators, I wasn't very clear in my presentation. There's really two parts to our request. Typically, our budget has been at $250,000 a year. In the last biennium, it was cut to $160,000. So we're asking for that restoration back to that $250,000 level. In addition, we are working with the Head Start Center, as I mentioned, with 22 Head Start Centers in the state of Minnesota. And we're asking a new allocation to cover for the mentoring costs for that process. And given the Senate combines all the education into one bill, we've presented it this way. Obviously, in the House, we have an early ed request for $75,000. So we're asking for, first, just a restoration back to our original budget, and the second would be to consider giving us the resources to be able to do a better job mentoring and training with Head Start Centers in Minnesota. As to the longevity and the model, I'm glad you asked that question, because the model is basically a three-year model where we work with a local district, and the local district sends teams of teachers to our training center, and the local district utilizes staff development money to pay for half of that training, and then the allocation from the legislation pays for the other half, as well as for all of the mentoring over a three-year period. And at the end of the three-year period, generally speaking, there's enough teachers in the building to be able to sustain the interventions in the school itself without us being there for mentoring. Now, we still will allow districts to send new hires who weren't part of that training to the workshops at a discounted fee so that the schools can have as many teachers as possible trained in this intervention.
And does the you mentioned a three-year kind of a working relationship with school districts. What, and I believe it was in your information, you said that it comes to, and I don't know if this is the dollar figure that is, it says $109 per student.
Right.
Is that how you calculate out? So if you go to a school district that has, 250 students, you'd calculate it out 250 times 109, or does the district pick?
Chairman Stump and Senators, the district decides to pursue this training, and we end up with an arrangement or an agreement that they're going to provide the space, and we're going to collect data, and we're going to provide the training and mentoring. The $109 figure is just a simple math calculation of the allocation we received divided into by the number of students that are involved in the SMART programs in the schools we've worked at. There isn't like a price we give, $109 per student.
So from your perspective, do you have to go out and hire extra staff to take on this new responsibility with the Head Start Centers, or is your current staff underutilized so that they have capacity to do that?
Chairman Stump and Senators, no, it's new staff, because the thing we realized working with the Head Start Early Childhood is that it's an entirely different industry, if you will. And so we have to change the training, the mentoring, the activities themselves. So it's new staff.
All right. Okay. Any other questions that committee members have? If any members have not visited your facility and gone through that, it's always a good place to go and see what's happening. So. Senator Rummel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move Senate.
Let me, just before you make a recommendation, I made a mistake before I mentioned that the $160,000 was in the current base. It's actually not in the base. It is part of the best practices grant, so it's actually a grant. So, Senator Rummel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move that Senate File 1175 be laid on the table for consideration in the Education Finance Omnibus Bill.
Okay. All right. On Senator Rummel's motion, any discussion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, the same sign. Motion is adopted. Thank you, Senator Rummel, and thank you, those who are testifying. Senator Terese Ray.
Mr. Chairman, I need to ask a favor. I have some students who have been here since 8:30 waiting for the hearing for my bill. I don't know if this will
okay.
be possible. That is, we can
is it possible to keep keep it very, very short? There, I'd
Absolutely.
Like to get to the Senate File 894. There's people here, quite a number of people here that have come, and I just we have to quit at 11. What we'll do, members, is we'll recess at 11, and then come back at 6 o'clock and pick up what we haven't done here, and then also the agenda for this evening. So,
okay. I'll do my best to do
yes,
this very quickly.
Very, very quickly. Senator Terese Ray.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Oops, I'm sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. I really appreciate this. We have some students who really need to go back to school, and they've been here in the morning, so I appreciate this opportunity to present Senate File 923. And with me, I have some students and some program directors that will help me present this bill and also answer to some questions. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, this is really an important issue for me. As you can imagine, I am an immigrant woman who came here 20 years ago and had the privilege to come directly to Minnesota. And when I came here, I had ample opportunity to attend some programs that gave me an opportunity not only to learn the language, but also to get acquainted with the culture and to get acquainted with many programs that were available to people like me who had limited English proficiency. So today, after 20 years, I am here before you to ask for your support for funding for these programs. And what I would like to say to you is that it is, I think it's very sad to see Minnesota where it is at today. 20 years ago when I came here, we had funding available to these programs, and the programs were available to everyone, and I went to school full-time as an adult to learn English. I came here when we had a large group of people coming from Vietnam and Laos, predominantly. There were only two Latinos in my school, and there were about 600 people in my school attending full-time from 8 in the morning to 4 p.m., and that is just not available in Minnesota anymore. My experience really gave me the opportunity to learn quickly. When I came here, I couldn't speak a word of English. And in 6 months of intense training, I was able to go to the University of Minnesota. So I think this is very important, and I am here to ask for your support. Senate File 923 will provide $10 million of new base funding for adult basic education in Minnesota. And with this funding, programs will be able to address waiting lists, maintain current programming, and strengthening and expanding services. And with me, I have some people who will be able to testify and answer some questions. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, members
Senator
of the committee.
Senator Tresray, you could give your name for the record, please.
Tom Citrin-Heisem. I'm the Legislative Issues Chair for Literacy Minnesota, which is a statewide advocacy group for adult basic education. Mr. Chair, committee members, I'd like to speak just briefly to a couple of pertinent points. First, why ABE is so important in the larger sense for our state's future. In terms of economic issues, employers identify lack of qualified workers as the biggest barrier to growth, economic growth in Minnesota. There are nearly 400,000 Minnesotans over age 25 that don't have a high school diploma. And we have approximately 200,000 students who are state residents who are foreign-born and who often lack adequate English skills. A few weeks ago, the Wall Street Journal reported on a major study that forecasted a serious decline in employee literacy over the next 25 years as baby boomers retire and there are less skilled people to replace them. So ABE helps fill some of that skill gap and prepare to move people into those jobs. I also wanted to mention the relationship to K-12 and early childhood issues, in that the educational levels of mothers is the single biggest influence on the educational attainments of their children. When parents are involved in their children's education, they earn better grades, attend school more regularly, complete more homework, show better attitudes and behaviors, and graduate themselves from high school at higher rates. One other thing I'd just like to throw in is that we often forget the impact of ABE in corrections. 70% of prisoners in correctional institutions in the U.S. scored at the lowest two levels in the National Adult Literacy Services. A number of studies have shown that increasing education reduces recidivism. And a Virginia study found that in a sample of 3,000 inmates, 49% of those who did not participate in education programs while they were incarcerated were reoffended compared to only 20% of those who did. And you may know that ABE is presented as throughout the state in through public schools, through community-based organizations, also in the corrections system. Adult basic education addresses these needs through English language learning, which is the majority of what we do, but also through GED preparation, basic skills assessments, and workforce education to over 76,000 Minnesotans last year. Last year, students also earned over 6,300 GEDs through ABE programs. One in every 11 diplomas or its equivalent issued in Minnesota is through ABE. English language learners comprise about 51% of all of our learners, but account for nearly about two-thirds, 66% of all learner hours. And that's because the intensity of services that English language learners need is much greater in order to move them through the system quickly and help them build the skills that they need. One example that one of our speakers will talk a little bit more about is in terms of how specifically ABE helps people. There is a pre-CNA or certified nurse aid course at Hubs to prepare them for the actual training in terms of improving their vocabulary, reading skills, background knowledge. Recently, all 18 students who had completed this program at the St. Paul Hubs Center went through the Red Cross course, and all 18 passed and were able to proceed towards getting their CNA certification. That was an unprecedented number. So that's according to the Red Cross. They never have a class where everybody graduates. So that just shows some of the specific impact that ABE can have on individuals. Just to conclude a little bit about how our effectiveness is now threatened by funding. Despite record demand for services, our funding has been nearly flat for 4 years since we were unallotted 4 years ago. The average hourly reimbursement rate since we're forward funded has fallen 35% since 2001. Our waiting lists are growing. We recently completed a poll of 13 of the largest consortia, which are the umbrella groups through which ABE is provided around the state. 10 of those 13 had waiting lists, or actually, sorry, 13 of them, but 11 of the 13 had waiting lists. Over 2,000 people were on the waiting lists at this time, and over 3,200 students had been turned away over the last 6 months for lack of adequate funding and space and classes. I also want to note that the Governor's Workforce Development Council report in 2006 supported an increase in base funding and restoration and growth funding, specifically to accelerate English language acquisition, which is, quote, critical to the integration of Minnesota's immigrant and refugee population into the state's workforce. We also, in conclusion, before I turn the mic over to our students, we completed a survey of about 30 consortia in the state. There's 55 in all, 53. 30 replied, and we asked them what would they do if they did receive additional funding through this bill. The highest thing that came through was working through waiting lists and expanding the intensity of classes. One of the problems we have is not just waiting lists, but not having adequate resources to provide enough hours of service each week for students to make the maximum progress that they could. Some of the other things that consortia said they would like to work on and would be able to do with additional funding is expanding the number of classes as well as adding year-round classes in some areas, helping students prepare in the transitions to higher education, working with community colleges to that end, expanding their GED programs, expanding workforce preparation such as the CNA program that I mentioned, expanding other worksite programs and computer instruction, and also staff specialized outreach such as to those with disabilities. One of the things that has happened in the last few years due to lack of funding is some of those kinds of services that work with specific groups in need, such as those with disabilities, have been cut back because we simply don't have the funding to provide those services. So without additional funding, we've gotten to the point where we've been told for years, do more with less. And I think we've been very creative statewide in our willingness and ability to do that. At this point, we've reached the maximum. Waiting lists are growing. We simply can't stretch ourselves anymore. So without funding, next year, many programs will actually be cutting services, and the waiting list will continue to grow. With that, I would like to conclude my testimony. Unless somebody has a question right now, I'd like to turn the mic over to one of our students.
All right. Thank you. Let me just see if I can summarize this a little bit. In the budget book, we have, I think, an 8% increase. That's what the budget sheet has. And last year, if you remember, in the E-12 or the K-12 bill, we added a 3% inflation factor to ABAs. And in the legislation that you have before you, well, in the governor's bill, the governor's recommending the addition of basically the 3% increase in 07, 08, and 09. And in the legislation that Senator Therese Ray, that you have, that equates to about a 26% increase.
Yes, sir.
In the proposal. So just to kind of allow members to kind of get the information out there.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
A comment just so you would know, committee members, that we didn't pull that number out of the air. What we looked at is there was initially an 8% growth factor each year, which was taken away 4 years ago. And prior to that point, we were able to pretty much keep up with the need statewide. When that was taken away and we were unallotted, our ability to meet the need kept falling. So that percentage is based on roughly where we would be today had the escalation phase not been taken out. And since we were able to meet the need under that formula, we feel we would be able to meet the need quite well today.
And I think that's part of the rationale for having reinstated the 3% growth factor, inflation factor last year. So. Okay. Can we have some others that would like to testify very briefly?
Yes, we'll do it very briefly.
We have 10 minutes, and then we have to be in session.
This is Elizabeth Tegan.
Oh, we don't have a session.
From the Hub Center in St. Paul.
Thank you. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for giving this chance. My name is Elizabeth. I came from Ethiopia in January 2006 at the age of 23. When I come here first, I start to have center class because I need to learn more English. English is my second language, so I have to approve my English language, so I go to help center. Then when I start here in help center, my language is step by step. I approve my language, and it's nice school help center for me. It's like my life because it helps for me language, on not only language, computers, other stuff like other skills. It's so nice for me. And then when I continue in help center class, I got another opportunity. That's so wonderful for me. I got pre-CNA classes, and I'm happy, and I continue the pre-CNA classes. It helps for me because my problem and other students' problem is language. English is second language. So when I continue in pre-CNA classes, I know more words. It's hard to strictly go to the college, community college, to continue the CNA classes. It's hard for language. So I continue in help center. It's like 5 months training to CNA classes, pre-CNA classes, and then the help center to contact to the Red Cross, and we are registered to Red Crosses. I start only 1 month. And I take there is 4 days, Monday to Thursday, only in Friday. Every Friday we back to help center. We discuss which one is hard, and we discuss our teacher. She's so very, very nice teacher. How she's explained briefly, we understand what she said, because I told you it's hard English for us, for foreigners. So she helped us very, very nicely, and we know more about languages. And then now I pass. I got my license. Right now I try to find a job, applies. Thanks to Help Center. And my plan is in the future to continue my classes. I want to be RN. I start step by step. Now I got my CNA classes, and then licensed practical nurse, and then I want to be RN. Thank you for help centers. I will be continue right now to help center because I have to approve my language. Adult education is so good. Thank you, my teacher and help center. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I have Mr. Armando Marquez, who also wished to
welcome.
Hello, my name is Armando Marquez. I just want to say that these programs are really important for us. I work from 5 o'clock to 2 o'clock in the morning. I get up in the morning. I go to school. And I need the program. I want to finish school, and I want to have a career before I have a kid. Because I don't want to work until 2 o'clock in the morning, and my kid will go to school in the day. And, you know, I won't be able to see him or play with him. So I want to be someone, so I can give what he needs or what she needs. So, and right now in the class, some of the classes are really full, so we have to, work it out to sit really close to each other because of all the students that we are. And when I started school, I had to wait for quite some time. I wait for 3 months to start it. I've been attending school for 5 years. I mean, I have to leave. I leave the school a couple of times because of my work schedule. We need this. We need the programs there to, be someone in the United States. I mean, you know, sometimes you don't get a good job if you don't speak the language, or you know, you will be working in places where you will get the minimum wage. And sometimes we can't support our kids, so then that becomes a problem, not just for us, but for other people, like, welfare and stuff like that. So if we have better education, you know, that will take more pressure of, I would say the government, because, you know, less people will be in welfare or government help. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Senator Therese Ray. Senator Weir.
Well, Mr. Chair, thank you. Students, are your teachers here? Either of them? Could we just have them stand and...
Judy Moore, you from the Knowledge Center.
No, thank you.
Thank you.
You really touched their lives. And
thank you, Senator Anderson.
Mr. Chair, I just have to make a comment in support of this program. I've been to visit the Hub Center several times in St. Paul, and it just I just think it's absolutely disgraceful that we have waiting lists for people who are coming there and across the state who want to learn English and who want to do that so that they can get a good job and so that they can help their children, read to their children, and help them with their schoolwork. And, you know, if we don't do that, you know, we all heard so compellingly at the beginning of the session about our needs for our future workforce in this state. And if we have workers who are not able to participate in the workforce or get higher education or help their children with their educations, we know that our state will not be successful in the future. So this is such a fundamental, basic part of our education programming that we need to adequately fund. And I, Mr. Chair, can I just make one more editorial comment since we have three whole minutes? Really quick. I just want to say to Senator Therese Ray, it just really gave me chills to hear you say that 20 years ago you were an immigrant trying to learn English, and now look at you today. It's really, it's really inspiring.
Thank you, Mr. Anderson. I came to Minnesota, so that was the good first step I took. So.
Senator Therese Ray.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think I would like to present a motion then, if the members don't have any more questions.
I think so.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, I would like to move that Senate File 923 be laid over for possible inclusion into the Omnibus Finance Bill.
Okay. In the E-12 Education
Finance. E-12 Bill. Education Finance.
On Senator Therese Ray's motion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, the same sign. Motion is adopted. Thank you
Thank
very
you,
much.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, members of the committee.
Members, I think we're going to go over just a little bit. We'll take up Senate File 894, and then Senator Bonhoff will chair, and we'll finish with Senator Pretner Solon's two proposals after 894. I don't think they'll take too long. Madam Chair, yeah, please join me.
Senator.
Madam Chair and members, I know you've been sitting for a long time. It's one thing you get a lot of around this place is a lot of chair seat time. this is a proposal that is in the governor's base. It's something that I've been familiar with over the last number of years, and it fits in quite nicely this morning with the testimony from a lot of the immigrant and minority testimony that we heard, the need for trying to get qualified teachers into our schools, and how do we get those qualified teachers? And this is a collaborative urban educator recruitment and training program, and a number of our colleges and universities here in the metropolitan area have taken it upon themselves to do that training and get those teachers primarily into the urban schools. I wouldn't say entirely, but primarily in there. And one of the problems that we have is having as our diversity rises, we don't have the kinds of educators with the same diversity, and that's very important. We've struggled over the last, I'd say 20-some years that I can remember, trying to get Native Americans trained as teachers to go into some of our schools on reservations, and it's a very difficult hurdle. We've had a number of programs. This particular program has been quite successful, and one that I'm going to kind of turn it over to them to kind of explain a little bit how it operates and where they, what information they want to share.
Madam Chair and committee members, my name is Doug Hennis. I'm Vice President for University and Government Relations at St. Thomas. I'm here to offer some general remarks about the programs that have been funded under the state's Collaborative Urban Educator Program. These programs are at St. Thomas, Concordia University, and St. Paul and Hamlin. And I will turn over, we've got several colleagues here who can speak about them as well. The three universities have developed programs to recruit, train, and retain more teachers of color, and then to ensure that younger teachers who end up in urban or urban-like settings to teach are properly equipped with the skills that they need to be successful. Our programs are all a little different. But they complement each other well, and we've collaborated now for about 10 years on them. The state has been an important partner in those programs. We've received funding. The St. Thomas program has received funding since 1997, and Concordia and Hamlin since 1998. We've also invested some of our own internal resources and raised private funds for the program as well. The governor, this biennium, the programs are funded about $1.05 million. The governor in his budget request has $1.55 million for the next biennium. We appreciate the legislature's past support of our efforts and what the governor has recommended. We, in the ideal world, we'd like to get back to the funding level we were at in the 2001 and 2003 biennial when the three programs received a total of $2.6 million
for the programs. Excuse me, Senator Stump, the bill that we have before us says 1.3 in 2008 and 1.3 in 2009, and that's what I understood from Mr. Nelman as well, and the right numbers that that Mr. Hennis are saying are a little bit higher than that. So are we recommending less than what's in the governor's budget?
Madam Chair, it's for the biennium, so right, it would be $2.6 million. Okay. That's what the legislation
good
says. The governor's recommendation right is a little bit less.
Okay, thank you very much.
You have information packets that include a summary of all three programs and also some background in each one of the programs, as well as some national data that show a correlation between having teachers of color in the classroom and what that means in terms of improved student performance. We have three people to speak briefly this morning. Zelma Wiley is an alumnus of the St. Thomas Q program, principal of Maxfield Elementary School in St. Paul. Next to her is Vu Thor, who is a student in the Concordia program. And next to me is Rosalind Carroll, who's an administrator at Hamlin and oversees their program. Selma?
Good morning, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Zelma Wiley. I'm the principal at Maxfield School in St. Paul.
Welcome.
Thank you. I'm really happy for the opportunity to share my story. 19 years ago, I was a paraprofessional in St. Paul schools with a deep desire to become a classroom teacher. But when I went to undergraduate and got my degree, I wanted a degree in anthropology and decided later that I wanted to become a teacher. It was my calling and my passion. When I heard about their Collaborative Urban Educator Program in St. Paul, I took full advantage of it. And it's one of the best things that I could have done. And I must say that 10 years ago or more, when I came here to testify in support of the Q program, I think this committee made a great decision to continue funding. And I'm back to do the same this year, to urge you to really consider continued funding for the Collaborative Urban Educator programs. As a teacher in the Collaborative Urban Ed program, I learned how to become a teacher leader. I learned not only to implement great strategies and teach the high standards, but I also learned how to mentor my students as well as my colleagues. And so I've moved on to become an administrator in St. Paul schools. And I'm very proud to say that at Maxfield, we have a great number of collaborative urban educator alumni. And it works for our school because we have a population of 76% African American students. We have 19% Southeast Asian students and 2 or 3% Hispanic students in our school. They are very well served by the people who look like themselves. Our parents feel very comfortable coming to our school because there are people there who are culturally competent, who know exactly what their needs are and can empathize with their lives and their situations. So I am hoping that I continue to be a mentor to people who were once paraprofessionals, who were in first careers and want to get into teaching as a second career. I am very honored to have mentored several of the students in the Collaborative Urban Ed program at the University of St. Thomas, and I continue to do that whenever I can with my teachers at Maxfield. Thank you for this great opportunity.
Thank you for your work.
Thanks.
Thank you. Good morning, Madam Chair and the committee. My name is Vu Thor, and I currently work as a paraprofessional for the St. Paul Public Schools. I've been there for almost 10 years now. I'm currently in the Southeast Asian Teachers Program at Concordia University, and the C program has given me an opportunity to pursue my dream and go forward with my career. Soon I'll graduate with my teaching degree and help close the achievement gap amongst students like myself who are bilingual and urban learners. I remember my family immigrating to this country over 25 years ago and attending elementary school, and there weren't many teaching assistants or teachers who are like me who can communicate with me and role models who I can look up to. Today, the C program has given me an opportunity to go back to school and become a role model teacher for urban learners like myself. I look forward to continue finishing up in the C program and hope that funding will continue for this program for future diversity teachers like myself. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Thor.
Thank you.
Good morning. My name is Rosalind Carroll, and I'm the Academic Director for the Center for Excellence in Urban Teaching at Hamline University. And I appreciate this opportunity to share with you what we are doing to help students in Minnesota. The funds that are provided help districts to provide the needed professional development. As these districts' budgets are getting slimmer and slimmer, Hamline and partners here, we work with these schools to continue to provide this professional development to teachers who are working with students day in and day out. Hamline works not only in St. Paul and Minneapolis districts, but we work with suburban and outstate districts as well. Wayzata, Bloomington, Northwest Suburban Integration District, inclusive of Elk River, Osseo, Duluth, just to name a few. Teachers know their subject matter. They understand the content. What we provide is how to take that content and engage students who do not look like them, have the same language as the teacher, or the same economic status, and oftentimes the same culture. We help teachers help these students to acquire and implement strategies that are inclusive of those students' cultures, abilities, resilience, and effort and motivation. When you look at the C in culture and the A in ability and the R in resilience and the E in effort, it spells care. What we do is help teachers help students care about education and relationships. All of the research says that when you have a good relationship with students, students do better. To engage students in education, it is important that the teacher can come from where the student is at to take the student to where they need to be. So if we're going to provide success in the MCAs, graduation, and self-esteem, this bill will help these three universities continue to prepare teachers and ultimately close the achievement gap. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Are there any questions? I just have a comment. We have been traveling around the state, the Education Policy Committee, and I remember being at Eden Prairie when Eden Prairie talked about their diversity, and they talked about the growing need to have teachers that reflected the changing population and that that was a challenge for them. And I think other schools besides just the urban schools are also facing that challenge. So programs like these can hopefully expand beyond, and I'm pleased to hear that you are working with those other schools.
One thing that might be worth pointing out, and I think the Hamlin program does a very good job of that because, you know, they go into different school districts around the state. In terms of the teacher training, the St. Thomas program, for example, has Q alumni, and there are 320 of them, and there will be 20 more graduating in June, but they are placed in over 100 schools in the Twin Cities area, primarily Minneapolis and St. Paul, but a growing number of suburban schools as well.
Good.
Madam Chair, I don't know if there's any other questions, but if the committee would entertain a motion, I would.
Oh, Senator Stempa, I think there's another gentleman who would like to testify in this bill.
Okay.
Madam Chair, committee members, thanks for taking the time out to listen to my testimony and staying past 11 o'clock. I appreciate that. For the record, my name is Ronald Lewis Schultz. I'm a lifelong St. Paul citizen and a student at Metropolitan State University, and I'll be brief with my testimony here. I come before you today on behalf of myself and other students of color, other underrepresented students, and other low-income students at Metropolitan State University, to request that Metropolitan State University's Urban Teacher Program be added to the list of institutions that receive funding under the Collaborative Urban Educator Program. The Urban Teacher Program at Metro State is one of only four education programs that I'm aware of in the state that focus on training persons to work in urban schools. While I recognize that Metro State already receives state funding, I must point out that it is the only one of the aforementioned four institutions that is not getting specific funding earmarked for their program. Now, tuition at Metro State is considerably lower than at Concordia, Hamlin, and St. Thomas Universities. However, that does not mean it is affordable for all. I myself am living proof of this. I'm a full-time single parent. I'm a full-time student. I work at Penumbra Theater on a production-to-production basis. I work at Harding High School as a tutor twice a week, and I'm also the caretaker of my apartment building. Now, I hold on to these jobs to make ends meet, but sadly, the ends don't always meet. I've been a recipient of Pell Grants, state grants, and a scholarship from 3M to help pay for my education costs. But these funding sources that I am truly grateful for, have not, unfortunately, been enough to cover the education expenses of all the expenses of higher education. And I can assure you I'm not the only person at Metro State in this type of, at best, stagnant financial position. Several of my classmates are also single parents and are also persons of color who would undoubtedly benefit from the additional financial assistance that the Q program could provide to Metro State's Urban Teacher Program. And by adding Metro State's Urban Teacher Program to the Q program, you will be expanding support to an educator program and recruitment program whose purpose is to meet the needs of the urban school and diverse student populations.
Now, I've chosen to become an urban teacher because I recognize, as do the supporters here of the Q program, that there is a need for more teachers of color to teach an increasingly diverse student population. I have gleaned valuable knowledge from the core courses in Metro State's Urban Teacher Program, courses that include a multicultural education, managing diverse learners, teaching and assessing learners with disabilities, and teaching and assessing English language learners. And I am certain that this knowledge will enable myself and others to become effective urban educators. Now, I believe education to be the foundation for the acceptance of differences, the cornerstone for developing compassion for all human beings, and the key that leads to the equality under our constitutional democracy. And by adding Metro State's Urban Teacher Program to the Q program and passing the bill, you will be supporting many more persons of color and underrepresented persons' drive to become urban educators. You will be showing that you accept differences, that you have compassion for all human beings, and that you share my belief that the key to equality is indeed education. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Schultz. Mr. Schultz, are you speaking on behalf of Metro State here today?
The students, myself included, I am not officially here from Metro State, as requested by Metro State. I'm here on my own volition.
Thank you, Mr. Schultz. And then I have a follow-up question, and so perhaps somebody from Metro State who might be here might have the answer. I don't know if you would have this answer, and that is, does Metro State have money for urban educators in their base that they do receive from the state? Is there anybody who can answer that question?
From Metropolitan State University, but I don't believe they do receive any funds. I am an alumni from the urban
education. Excuse me, if you're going to speak, you'd have to state your name for the record.
Yeah, my name is Maria Toledo. Thank you for this opportunity. And we're here to advocate more for the fact that we need urban teachers. I am an urban educator, and I went through the urban teacher program at Metropolitan State University, and I enjoy and I experience the opportunity to learn how to work with diverse population. And as my immigrant experience showed me and helped me to be more empathetic with other experiences of the students that are facing big challenges in the school system today. So for the urban teacher program at Metropolitan State University, we will... we're here to make sure that there are more urban teachers, that we get the funding when it becomes to student teaching, for example, that we had to work full-time as a teacher, but we cannot work because we are entirely devoted to the work that we're doing in the school and also finishing our student teaching. And that's one of the few issues or many issues that we face as urban teachers.
Thank you very much. Thank you. And members, we're just trying to get clear what it is that Metro State is doing. So I believe there is somebody here with regard to the budget. Thank you so much for your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members, mindful of the time. My name is Tom Cook. I work with the President and Director of Government Relations at Metropolitan State University. In session law in 2000, through the higher ed accounts, Metropolitan State did receive funding for a period of time to launch and continue an urban education, urban teacher program specifically.
And Mr. Cook, thank you. So is that money currently in your base on an ongoing basis?
I believe so. I could check that out in more detail and get that back to the committee.
Thank you very much. Any other questions? Senator Saltzman, did you still have a question?
Well, just a quick question is to see where the money goes. I was just looking at the inside here, Concordia College results. 23 students are currently enrolled in the program. And if the funding is for $400,000 per year, is that about $17,000 per student?
No. This biennium... you're talking about the St. Thomas program. Talking about Concordia. Sally can respond. Regarding the St. Thomas program, there's about $330,000 this biennium. We are able to do one cohort, which has about 25 students in it now. Under our proposal, if we can get expanded funding, we would have four cohorts with a total of 100 students. So obviously, more funding, more ambitious programs, more students coming out and being placed in schools. Sally?
Please state your name for the record.
Yes, I'm Sally Boss. I direct the Southeast Asian Teacher Licensure Program at Concordia University, ESL, and the Hmong Culture and Language Program as well. And your question was about responding about 23 students being part of our program. When our funding was cut more than in half over the last couple biennia, we reduced our program from 40 students to 23 because we were unable to fund them to the same level. We fund half their tuition, their books, and a laptop for their use because we are a laptop university. And so that kind of explains our funding, I think.
Thank you. Senator Saltzman.
So just on those figures, Madam Chair, so it's about $10,000 per student.
It costs about $10,000 per student.
Sort of the subsidy. And yes. Metropolitan State tuition at Metropolitan State, would we know what that amount would be per student?
I don't know that.
Mr. Cook.
Madam Chair, I'm not sure about the per student cost. I'd have to get back to you on that. The tuition runs about $5,500 a year for full-time students now, for undergraduates.
Thank you. Senator Hand.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just one very brief question, quick question, Senator Stumpf. And I support the bill. I think in previous years I've actually been a co-author on a similar type of bill, and I support the work that the universities are doing to provide opportunities to train teachers and the skills needed to teach in an urban environment. But I do have to ask a question, Senator Stumpf. Our Constitution in Article 13, Section 2, prohibits the state from spending tax money in religious schools. And I just would like to know if you had a comment on how we can do this and still comply with the Constitution.
Madam Chair, Senator Hand.
Senator Stumpf.
We spend money through the state grant program on an annual basis to which goes out to students, and I don't know if this is exactly the same route, but we do in K-12 too to some degree. We provide transportation, we provide books, we provide special education funding. We provide a number of different funding from the state to schools that are, or students basically, that are in non-public schools.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you.
So, Madam Chair, if there are no other questions, I would move that Senate file number 894 be laid on the table for possible inclusion in the Omnibus Education Finance Bill.
Very good. On Senator Stump's motion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. Motion carries.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members.
So now we'll be moving to the Senator Solon's Senate File 693.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I will be brief. Actually, there are two bills, 693 and 694.
We'll Thank you, Senator Solon.
One of them is for an annual appropriation, and the other is a grant for a specific project. And I'll start by giving you a brief overview of the museum. The Duluth Children's Museum is the oldest in the state and the fifth oldest children's museum in the nation, and it was established in 1930 by an educator, Ms. Mabel Wing, who observed the Brooklyn Children's Museum and used that as a model for a development in Duluth. Additionally, the Duluth Children's Museum is the only organization of its type in northeastern Minnesota, serving a broad population from a radius of over 200 miles. Membership in the organization continues to grow, as does support from both public and private sources. Senate File 693 appropriates $50,000 each year to the Duluth Children's Museum from the General Fund through the Minnesota Department of Education. This is a biannual request that will fund the educational program services and curriculum support the museum offers to educators who take advantage of both on- and off-site program services. And then Senate File 694 appropriates $113,234 in one-time money to support a design for early childhood at the museum. And this is a space dedicated to the needs of infants, toddlers, and preschoolers and their caregivers, ensuring them a dedicated, fun learning space within the overall context of the museum space. The project will be administered by CEO and President Michael Garcia, with implementation by a team including the Director of Exhibits, the Curator of Collection, and the Director of Educational Program Services. And as I mentioned, these funds are a one-time request and will greatly help the museum to upgrade their current exhibits. And today I have with me Michael Garcia, President and CEO of the Duluth Children's Museum, and he will provide you with more in-depth information about the museum as well as the projects and exhibits that will benefit from the state funds.
And Senator Solon, before we hear from your guest, I have a couple questions with regard to the bills. With Senate File 693, there are tails associated with those numbers. Did you intend for that to be the case?
Madam Chair, if you're $50,000 a year, is that what you're referring?
Correct.
Yes, I would like to see this as an ongoing appropriation similar to Minnesota Museum. And this request was based on 5% of its annual budget, which was similar until this morning's request to what the Minnesota Museum was requesting.
Thank you, Senator Solon. And then one other question with regard to Senate File 694. Mr. Nelman has advised me that we generally don't put our appropriations down to that level of detail. So would you be willing to amend the amount you're asking for to either $114,000 or $113,000?
Madam Chair, whatever your pleasure, we'd be willing.
Senator Wieger moves that this be amended to
$114,000.
All in favor of Senator Wieger's motion, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion carries. Thank you. Mr. Garcia.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Michael Garcia. I'm President and CEO of the Duluth Children's Museum. I'm honored to be before you today, and I do have some materials for distribution to members of the committee. I want to say that my involvement with the Duluth Children's Museum has spanned a period of over 25 years. I grew up in Virginia, Minnesota, and was fortunate to have the wealth of the school district during the time of my teens in the 1950s and the wealth of opportunities that that afforded children growing up at that time. When I moved to Duluth, I became affiliated with the Duluth Children's Museum over 27 years ago as a volunteer, and later went on to serve on the Board of Trustees of the Children's Museum. Subsequently, I moved to St. Paul, where I actually became familiar with members of this committee while I was Deputy Director of the Achievement Plus program, a St. Paul education reform program that many of you are familiar with. I've also been a trainer in the Urban Learner Framework that Dr. Carroll just represented, the point being that my life has been dedicated to education and to young people. In returning to Duluth from St. Paul 7 years ago, what I found at the Duluth Children's Museum was an opportunity to serve young people and their caregivers in a way that was critically important to me as an individual coming out of an educational experiential background and seeing so many young people today without that opportunity. The Duluth Children's Museum had completed an educational master plan with the assistance of a consultant, Jean Vergeron, who is an educational leader and doctor in educational curriculum development here in St. Paul. What we discovered at the Duluth Children's Museum, and at that time I was serving as trustee, not as its president, was that we had an opportunity to greatly expand our membership and our reach within our region. And at that time we were serving 77 households through family membership, serving 220 students. Today, 24 months later, we have a membership base that last week passed 523 households, serving just over 2,500 individuals. Those individuals come from one of the most needy economic areas in the state of Minnesota. We know from the Blueprint on Ending Poverty that's being developed in Duluth that the St. Louis County area and the region in which the Children's Museum reaches out to serves 32% of the families in that area live below an earnable, a livable wage in their household. The Duluth Children's Museum provides a unique opportunity for the caregivers, whether they be parents, grandparents, or daycare providers, and for the young children. And through this bill, what we're seeking to do is expand the educational value of our early childhood development space. Right now, that space is extremely limited in the museum, and what we're finding is in the great expanse of our membership is there's an increased number of members who are coming in with family members or other caregivers who are from birth to 3 years old. So we want to take our campsite area in that museum, and we want to dramatically increase it. This effort will be led by educators. I can assure you that the museum, in its 78 years, has been led by educators. The people behind the museum who will lead this effort both hold degrees in education. They write curriculum for every program, and they provide it free to all school teachers throughout the region that we serve and across the nation. Our membership spans from Paris, France, all the way across the United States. We were visited last week by an educator and her daughter from Seattle, Washington, who comes three times a year and who travels the world and said, the thing that inspires me most about Duluth is that you are unusual in that you have 15,000 cultural artifacts. Of the 630 children's museums in the nation, only approximately 15 of us are culturally based and artifact based. The Duluth Children's Museum is one of the first in the nation, happened to have been established in that framework, and it provides both the adult and the child the opportunity to view objects that relate to the learning experience. We're very fortunate to have this in Duluth. We want to expand our service to more families. Approximately 12% of our annual memberships are awarded on a scholarship basis to low-income households, and we see that increasing to 15% next year and 18% the year after that with state support. We are also working on a congressional level. I just returned 2 weeks ago by invitation of Congressman Oberstar and his wife, where we are working on a national level to increase the funding for the museum at that level. Thank you very much, and I'd be glad to entertain any questions. I know we've gone well over.
Mr. Garcia, I just want you to know that the lack of attendance is certainly not a reflection of how important the museum is, because as you've seen, we are going over, so people have other committees, but we believe deeply in what you're doing there. Yes, Senator Weaker.
Well put, Madam Chair. And I'd like to move that Senate File 693 be laid over and recommended for inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Very good. I do have one question before we vote on that motion. Thank you, Senator Weaker. How much do you charge just on a one-time visit, and is there any kind of sliding fee for just an individual visit?
Mm-hmm. The situation is that we're housed in the historic Union Depot, which is part of 9 cultural organizations in Duluth, and the Children's Museum does not administer the admission. That's administered there. Families in that situation, adults pay $10 and children pay $5.50. However, the Duluth Children's Museum has an independent membership program, reciprocal program with the Science Center of Minnesota and the Minnesota Children's Museum, where if you become a household member, which starts at $55 per household, you're admitted free on an annualized basis to all of the exhibits at the museum. Additionally, once a month throughout the academic year, we offer what we call family days and member days, which is a $2 admission fee per person. We also, as the Duluth Children's Museum, offer a free pass to every social service agency in our region who applies for it. So the Duluth Regional Care, the Duluth Public Libraries, the WISE, so on and so forth, have passes that they can hand families so that they're not turned away for lack of economic opportunity.
Thank you.
Thank
so
you,
with
Madam
that,
Chair.
Ms. Senator Solon, you have anything else to add?
Only, Madam Chair, that this is a phenomenal resource in northeastern Minnesota, and if any members are in the area, I'd love to give you a tour.
Thank you. We'll follow up on that. On Senator Weaker's motion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed, same sign. The motion is passed. Thank you very
Madam
much.
Madam Chair, same motion for Senate File 694 as amended.
As amended. Very good. So we have to vote on that again. Okay, I'm sorry. We'll now vote on Senator Wieger's motion to pass Senate File 694 to be as amended to be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. Motion is passed. At this point, members, we will
Thank
be
you,
recessing
Chair.
Until 6 p.m. this evening. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Yes. Oh, thank you. No, I didn't know that.